subcommittee of the committee on House Committee on Revenue, and we'll begin at this particular point. And we're going to have a public hearing on. We're going to begin with House Bill 2452. So we will now open the subcommittee will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2452. Elizabeth.
Chairman Butler and committee members, today you're going to go through a couple bills here from the Department of Revenue, and there, a lot of them are dealing here with pass-through entities. So this first one here is House Bill 2452, and it's basically dealing with the guidelines in which pass-through entities can actually file a composite personal income or corporate excise tax return with the Department of Revenue. And they do this on behalf of a non-resident owner who chooses to have and become part of this composite return. And so then once they become part of this composite return, then the pass-through entity will pay taxes on the behalf of that non-resident owner. It basically is specifying that the composite income tax return must include at least one non-resident owner, and then it outlines the components of the composite income tax return, such as you have to specify the share of the distributive income from Oregon sources of each electing owner there on that composite return, and the amount of tax then that will be withheld by the pass-through entity for each electing owner. Now, it's allowing an electing owner to file the non-resident personal income tax return or corporate excise tax return, but then they get credit for the amount of tax that was paid by the pass-through entity on their behalf. So it also then in Section 3 of the bill, we're going then into outlining the conditions under which a pass-through entity shall withhold income taxes for non-resident owners' distributive income if they aren't part of that composite income tax return. So basically this is the important section that has some revenue implications for the Department of Revenue. They just have trouble getting some of the withheld tax or getting any taxes on the distributive income from pass-through entities if they aren't part of a composite return or under current law they're calling it a multiple resident return. So basically under current law we're taking those non-residents who choose to be part of a combined return, having those non-residents have the personal income tax withheld by and paid by the pass-through entity. But for those non-resident owners who don't want to be part of that return, they don't have to. And the entity then, the pass-through entity, is not paid in withholding tax. So what Section 3 of this bill is doing is it's requiring, if you have one or more members that are non-residents, to withhold those taxes. So basically that's a major change in the bill is Section 3. And then it's outlining the conditions under which basically the pass-through entity does not have to withhold taxes, and that's if there's only a small amount of pass-through income, like less than $1,000, and a few other conditions. This all applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st of 2006. This act will replace ORS 314.760, so I did copy that ORS for you just so you know what current law is. That's basically what you have there in your packet. It's ORS 314.760. So basically, again, with this bill, it's going to could potentially increase state general funds by providing the Department of Revenue with an additional mechanism basically for withholding taxes and collecting taxes from the pass-through entities that they don't have currently under current law. But the amount of additional taxes that they'll collect each year is really indeterminate but minimal and less than $50,000 a year.
Thank you. let me just ask a question then. So if this is for pass-through entities, including trusts, general trusts, and so if we have a trust, which is an Oregon situs trust, which has assets in multiple states, but passive investments, what do we call those passive investments anyway, within the state of Oregon, but beneficiaries who may be receiving some of the Oregon passive income, then the trustee, when a distribution is made to the beneficiaries, a non-resident, two or more non-resident beneficiaries would have to withhold Oregon income tax on that amount?
Chairman Butler, I think we better, Deborah really, you know, dealt with the trustee issue because I'm not exactly sure. If they're set up such that they're a pass-through entity, then yes. But I think we better have Deborah answer
okay.
that one.
Okay. Other questions?
That's the right idea.
Okay.
That's right. Under current law, basically only shareholders and partners of an S corporation or a partnership would be the ones who, if they elect, those non-resident owners, if they elect to be part of this composite return, and the non-resident return filed by that S corporation or partnership, then they would be withholding tax. They would be paying that those taxes for that non-resident owner for that income that they're going to be receiving as a pass-through income. But under this bill, you would be requiring that entity then for the other non-residents that didn't want to file in a composite return, they would have to then withhold taxes.
Have withholding
yes.
on their distributive share.
That's right. And one point, too, to just clarify, because it isn't really specified well in the bill, is it doesn't really deal with the timing of these payments. So I don't know if that's something you want to specify at all in the bill, but it's not specified in Section 2 or Section 3 about with the composite returns, when would the pass-through entity be required to make those payments. And in Section 3, it doesn't say exactly when the pass-through entity would be required to make withholding. You'd think it'd be monthly withholding, but, you know, it's...
Anytime the distribution is made, probably,
yeah.
Using the federal and state guidelines. Deborah, would you like to come forward? Thank you very much for coming today. We always appreciate hearing the rest of the story. So we appreciate you coming, and please help us struggle through some of those issues, if you would, please, Deborah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, if I could just give you a little more background before I try to answer your question.
Please.
We're bringing this proposal to you as a uniformity recommendation from the Multi-State Tax Commission. This is one that they proposed in 2003 for the states to consider. As Lizbeth noted, we currently do have the authority to provide for composite filing, and I have in your packet, or separate from your packet, there is this handout that has an attachment with it that shows what we now have for the multiple non-resident filings. So that is this information, and currently this is what we use for those pass-through entities, the non-resident owners that choose to join in this composite return. So once again, this is coming from a uniformity recommendation of the Multi-State Tax Commission. It reflects pretty much what we have now in practice for the multiple non-resident filings. So we don't see a lot of difference between current practice and what this bill would provide on the filings. There is the withholding piece that would apply, and that is something new. Currently, if a group of non-resident owners joins in a multiple non-resident filing, the entity will pay tax for all of them on their behalf, so they don't then have to file an individual return with us separately. So that is an administrative ease for the entity and also for those non-resident owners and also for the department, because we're getting one return with tax payment rather than a number of individual returns.
Deborah, what rate would the tax be calculated at that point for pass-through entity?
Mr. Chair, it's calculated at the highest marginal rate, and the back of that packet has an example of how a multiple non-resident return and the tax is calculated. And unless you want me to, I won't take the time to walk through that, but this does indicate that in the second column, for example, you have a single taxpayer and you have one who's filing married joint, so they go to the tables and calculate the tax.
Would that, under the rules of the multi-state tax commission, would that credit be allowed as a full tax credit and used in calculating the tax credit for a tax-paying state at the other end?
The credit for taxes paid to another state, Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, they can take that, and this example actually has residents of California. And because we're a state where we allow the credit to a California resident, then they can calculate that and take it on the composite return.
Okay. And let me ask, with regard to a partnership, which would include an Oregon corporation, would that partnership, as it earns resources, and withhold at 9% when a corporate rate is 6.6?
Mr. Chair, I believe the bill specifies the maximum corporate rate would be paid, and I think that's on page 2 of the bill, starting at line 17. They withhold at the rate applicable under ORS 317.061. So I believe that would be the 6.6% for a corporate partner.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Haft, recognized.
Elizabeth, can you possibly give us an example here of where this case would, where this bill would help?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haft, assume that you have 6 partners. 3 are Oregon residents, 3 live in New York. The partnership operates a business in Oregon and generates income. The partnership can file a multiple non-resident return on behalf of all 3 of those New York partners, as long as they have no other Oregon income.
But it's elective.
It is elective,
okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So those partners choose to have the partnership file on their behalf. The partnership calculates the income that would go to those 3 New York partners and calculates the tax based on whether they're single or married. The partnership then files a multiple non-resident return with Oregon showing the income that went to those 3 partners along with the payment of the tax that they would have owed had they each filed an individual tax return.
And it's elective at what end? If 2 of the partners in New York elect to have it done, it's a partnership election?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Each partner chooses whether or not they want to be a part of that return.
So, but it shifts the obligation then to the partnership entity itself to then receive that election by the New York, by 2 of the New York partners, 2 of the 3 New York partners, to have their tax. And let's say that we're distributing $100,000 apiece. That the income is $100,000 apiece, regardless of the distribution, and that they're all individual partners, and that then the $100,000 they receive, they say go ahead and make the election in Oregon. Those New York partners, the 2 that made the election, would receive $91,000 apiece, net of a $9,000 withholding, which they would then have to report to the New York State, if I recall New York's tax returns. Let's just call it New York State, not any city or county return. And so then they would report $100,000. They would also then report a $9,000 credit for taxes paid in another state under the multi-state tax commission.
Mr. Chair, you're describing the new?
Right, under the
what
new.
What would come in under the new one?
Under this new proposal.
If the partners did not choose to join in the composite filing, then yes, there would be a withholding that is sent to Oregon from the income that's distributed to them. Then they would file an individual return with Oregon as well as New York. On the Oregon return, they would be entitled to...
If they chose not to participate.
Yes, sir.
But if they chose to participate, they would not be filing an Oregon tax return.
That's correct.
They would be filing a New York State tax return and reporting $100,000 gross and reporting $9,000 state withholding subject to the subject to New York State tax credit.
Mr. Chairman, the withholding would be credited on the
Oregon.
Right.
But they could use it as a credit for taxes paid to other states and New York State.
I believe that the income that Oregon and New York are both taxing, they would be able to use
right.
a credit.
It just short circuits the fact that you wouldn't have an extra filing of 2 New York partners and the calculation of their income and the paperwork of that particular group. Now, if the 3rd partner decided that they wanted to participate in this same $100,000 distribution and they were a New York corporation, then they would receive their check for $100,000 less $6,600 at the 6.6%, and then they would file theirs with regard to their state tax. Any ability by the partner to receive a refund if their other sources of Oregon income were a loss?
Mr. Chairman, one of the provisions is that if they have other income, they can't participate in a multiple non-resident filing.
Okay, so if they have other income and or in the resident state of Oregon or in the non-resident state of Oregon,
rental property, then they would need to be filing an individual tax.
But we just said just a moment ago that it was a partnership election or it's a partner election.
It is a partner election.
Okay, all right. Did you finish your presentation? We interrupted you, Deborah.
I believe I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Berger is recognized. Representative Berger.
I thought I understood it.
Until I asked questions.
Until you asked the question. No. What you described in terms of the three New York and the three Oregon and the corporation is what is in this bill. Without this bill, each one of those people would have had to individually file?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Berger, the current law allows for a composite filing. So they can do that now under existing law and rules that are in place and have been for 15 years.
So what's new?
What's new is a small change in the language to adopt the Multi-State Tax Commission's recommendations around uniformity, but the withholding piece for individuals who don't participate in the composite filing is the new major new piece here.
Got it. So it's sort of a little stick to encourage them to do it this way because you're going to get withheld. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Berger, it does provide an incentive for people to file their returns, individual returns, if they have not joined in a composite filing.
It's because a carrot, they have not a stick. It's a little carrot. Okay. I think I get it.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. And if I have made an election to have the partnership, and it's mandatory if I make that election, that the partnership does pay the withholding through the state of Oregon. And it would be based upon my distributive share, not upon what I'm actually distributed. In other words, following the strict rules of partnership law.
I believe that is what the bill provides.
For the pass-through interest, whether or not it's distributed is of no moment relative to the withholding. The question I have then is that if I am a partner that's making that election or asks for the withholding and come back to my New York partners and I have this $100,000 that's being distributed to me net of the $9,000 withholding, in the year that I come forward and have that done in year X, then everything goes smooth. In year Y, or X plus 1 rather, I have decided that what I want to do is start to get ready for my subsequent move to the state of Oregon, and I invest in other business property in the state of Oregon and have other transactions in the state of Oregon. Is there any, and the partnership knows nothing of my subsequent investments in the state of Oregon, is there any way for me to get the $9,000 credited back to my individual Social Security number as a New York resident so that I can come back to the state of Oregon and say, wait a minute, I've already got $9,000 paid to the state of Oregon and I have other activity in the state of Oregon and need to pay a little more or receive a portion of a refund back from the state?
Mr. Chair, if I understand the question, you're asking what happens when they change status during the year and then are not eligible to participate.
Exactly, and the tax has already been paid or withheld.
We do have a provision under the current law that says if a partner becomes ineligible to participate at any point in the year, they can then opt out and file an individual return, and they would be able to transfer
and receive that credit individually.
Right.
It's not the partnership that has to make that election or request. Okay.
And I would assume that the rules that we adopt under this would be similar to that so that a person isn't punished when they aren't eligible to participate perhaps toward the end of the year and then need to file an individual return.
Further questions of Deborah? Colleagues, this is one of a number of revenue bills that we'll be hearing on behalf of the Department of Revenue. And the hard part of it is this is not necessarily the most difficult one. So, welcome on board. If we need if we need just a little bit of extra opportunity to ask questions of either Elizabeth or Deborah, I would invite you to do so afterwards. I think we'll probably go ahead and finish our public hearing on this, Deborah, and then invite members to, and then we do have a couple of members who have asked to be excused and who are excused today, and we recognize that we want to bring them up to speed. And that I did have the question of the trusts, and I think the trust is going to follow the same pastor entity rules from what, unless you tell me otherwise, that you've just described in the partnership, Deborah.
Mr. Chair, I believe you're correct. The bill does have a definition for non-resident, and it includes in that a trust that is not a resident trust. So a non-resident trust would be able to participate as a non-resident.
At the risk of maybe talking about something that I probably shouldn't talk about in an open meeting, if I have a trust and as a trustee, a member of a state with a trustee, a beneficiary who is in a very low tax state, a 6% maximum marginal bracket state, and the trust creates the primary source of income for that particular resident, then that trustee would, or that beneficiary, I can't use those terms interchangeably, that beneficiary would just not make the election and would go ahead and let's come back to our $100,000, and that's the sole source of income that they have, living in a very low tax state. Then do we anticipate that they would not make the election as a trustee, ask that the trust not withhold anything on them, and then receive the full $100,000 reported in that low income, low trust state, and because it was passive income in the state of Oregon, taxable to the state of Oregon, taxable to the trust in the state of Oregon and the beneficiaries, then the trustee or the trustee would report that as Oregon income on the K-1 to the trust beneficiary. Then they would go ahead from that point and file their resident tax state and the Oregon non-resident tax return, reporting the $100,000 in both places. And as I said, this is their sole source of income. They would end up paying, depending upon what all of their issues were, maybe something significantly less than $9,000 to the state of Oregon, because of based upon the proration of it. They would receive 100% of all of the deductions, 100% of many of the other kinds of itemized deductions and so forth, and then maybe pay a tax. Let's say that the tax of the state of Oregon is $5,000 and the tax of the resident state was $5,000, but they've just washed that out with the resident state. So really what we've got in a trustee is a situation with a beneficiary of a trust, is that beneficiary would just elect against receiving the proceeds net of the tax.
Mr. Chair, they could do that, but I think eventually they would need to file and pay with us anyway. The only thing they have to say there is just the withholding requirement.
Yeah, they would just escape the withholding requirements, and they would still file and they would still pay, but they wouldn't pay $9,000. Maybe pay $5,000 or $6,000, and then go back to their low tax state where they lived and say, incidentally, my tax paid to the state of Oregon was $6,000. My tax to my resident state is $4,000. That resident state says, tough luck. You've got it from a high tax state and you paid the higher tax. There's no, they'll wipe out the tax that was due to the resident state, the low tax resident state at that particular point.
Right.
Okay.
If I follow that.
Yeah, I think we're on the same line. My concern is that it doesn't cost, they don't have additional administration issues, and it doesn't cost a beneficiary or a partner. Can a partner elect in and out?
Yes.
Elect in on 1 year, elect out on year two, elect back in on year three?
Yes.
Okay. It's just an administration issue. And how many states are members of the multi-state tax compact?
Mr. Chair, I want to say 2025, but that's probably not correct because I'm just doing that from memory. So I can get you that information.
No, that's I was hoping that you'd tell me all states were members. And that
I know not all states are members, okay. Mr. Chair. Nevada
all
is
right.
not a member.
Other questions of Ms. Buchanan? Thank you, Deborah. We appreciate your explanation. With that, colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2452, and we'll come back and visit that when we have a full committee. Deborah, I will charge you with the please making certain that those members who are not here have an opportunity to visit with you at some point. I apologize for putting you through the extra hoops, but I know that you're a willing soul woman and a great sport on these kinds of things.
Easy.
I'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2453.
Chairman Butler, with House Bill 2453, this is another Department of Revenue bill. This is a little bit more straightforward, I think. Basically, what it's doing is it's just eliminating the current law time period for taxpayers to claim a refund or be given a notice of deficiency for income gains, losses, deductions, or credits that are from a pass-through entity. Basically, under current law, we've already had a bill kind of dealing with refunds and things, but basically, again, under current law, taxpayers can receive a refund after 3 years from the time period in which the return was filed or 2 years from the time the tax or portion of the tax was paid, whichever period is longer. So basically what this is doing is this is eliminating that time requirement under current law, but just for that amount of income that is passed through, again, from a pass-through entity. For that taxpayer who is receiving that pass-through entity income, they basically would not have to confine to this three-year structure. And basically the same three-year structure is also a three-year time period is also in place for that notice of deficiency. So Deborah will talk about, but basically the Department of Revenue has had difficulty in verifying that income gains, losses, deductions, or credits that are from a pass-through entity when they arrive on a tax form. And they especially have difficulty if the partnership or S corporation fails to file a tax return timely. So basically this is eliminating this time period will help then the Department of Revenue to have time to verify this income from the pass-through entity without the current law time constraint. So this could allow some additional revenue to come in from the Department of Revenue's collections. And so the overall revenue impact is again, minimal but indeterminate and less than $50,000 a year.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Deborah, can we have you come forward, please, on 2453? And you have previously explained this, I think, when we were changing the relating clauses on these, but I'd like you to feed us the full meal deal again, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. As Liz Beth has explained, this is fairly straightforward. What we have in law now are time limitations on our ability to audit returns and issue billings for additional tax. The general rule is that we have 3 years after a return is filed to take a look at that, examine it, determine whether there are errors on it, make adjustments, and send out bills. The problem that arises is if we have an individual who also has an interest in a pass-through entity, let's go back to the partners, who are partners in a partnership. If a partner files the return on time and the 3 years runs, then we can't adjust that return. The problem is if the partner didn't report partnership income and the 3 years goes by, we can't adjust that return, even though the partnership may not have yet filed the return. So you have an individual filing timely, leaving off some income. A partnership return hasn't been filed, so we don't know that there should be partnership income on that return. Then when the partnership files and we look at it, we look at the partner return, discover there's no income reported, and we can't do anything about it. So this would match up those time periods to say, even if the 3 years for the partner has run, we have 3 years from the filing of the partnership return, if that's later, to go back and adjust the partner's return just for that item or items coming off that pass-through entity return. Now, it would also work the other way, so that if a partner didn't get what's called the Schedule K-1 that reports their income or loss, if the partner didn't get that and for some reason they didn't ask about it, maybe they had a loss on that K-1 that they didn't include on their tax return. So then if the partnership files that 4 years later and sends them that K-1, they'd be able to go back, amend, claim the loss, and get the refund just for that item that wasn't reported by the partnership.
Thank you, Deborah. Questions of Deborah of this particular issue? Again, this is a much simpler issue, still dealing with pass-throughs, but also deals with the timing of the opportunity to pay the tax or to file a refund. Are there any questions about this particular issue? Colleagues, it's my intention to go ahead and work this bill today to pass it to the floor of the House. Is there a subsequent referral on this, by any chance?
No.
Great. Another bill that gets through the process. Any objections to going ahead and closing the public hearing before we move into a work session? Thank you very much, Deborah. I'll close then the public hearing on House Bill 2453, and I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2453. Representative Olson now moves 2453 to the House with a due pass recommendation.
Affirmative.
Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, and recognizing that, let's stand at ease for just one moment. Stand at ease. In a work session on House Bill 2453, Representative Olson has moved House Bill 2453 to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? The clerk will call a roll, please. Colleagues, normally I wouldn't do that, but we've got a couple of members that are excused, and I'll need to show them as excused on the roll.
Representative Esquivel?
Yay.
Representative Felicio?
Here.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Barber?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Haas? Aye.
Chair
Haas? Aye. With the excused members, Representative Boquist and Representative Comp, all members voting aye. So the record.
I speak Spanish sometimes.
Mr. Chair, he's just used to saying no contest.
House Bill 2453 is passed unanimously of all members present and moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Carrier?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to recommend that you carry this because we all can't wait to be on the floor when you explain a pass-through entity to the full body.
Okay. I'll carry this to the full. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2453. Elizabeth, be by my side. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2454. Elizabeth?
Okay. Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2454, this again is dealing with pass-through entities income. And this is dealing with the allocation procedure. Basically, we're putting in statute the allocation procedure for the pass-through entities income, gains, losses, deductions, or credits for part year and non-residents. So it's specifying that the allocation to Oregon of the income gains and losses and deductions or credits from a pass-through entity shall be based on the percent of total days in the tax year that the taxpayer was a resident of Oregon for part year residence. And then it's doing the same then for non-residents, except for it's based on the total number of days that the taxpayer was an Oregon non-resident. So basically, this is all applying to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2002. It also then allows audits or adjustments to occur by the Department of Revenue for any tax years in which the tax return is under appeal or any tax year in which the claim for refund may be made after the effective date of this 2005 Act. Now, as you might have guessed, of having an effective date of January 1st, 2002 is an indication that we're kind of codifying in law here in the statute, something the Department of Revenue is already doing. Okay, so under current law, Department of Revenue is already having this particular allocation process in place through their rule. So they already have this rule for part-year residents and for Oregon non-residents. Basically, this is the result of a court ruling, and Department of Revenue has already put this in the rule. This is just bringing this forward in the statute, so it will have no revenue impact from current law.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Any questions of staff? Let's go ahead and invite for our public hearing Deborah Buchanan, please, to come forward. Thank you very much, Deborah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. As staff explained, this is coming from a court decision in 2001 that dealt with a person who moved into Oregon during the year. And the question was how the income from a subchapter S corporation should be divided up for that taxpayer. We had interpreted federal law to mean that if a person is a resident of Oregon the last day of the year and the entity and the individual have the same year, if they're a resident of Oregon, then all of the income from that flow-through entity or pass-through entity is included in Oregon income. If they weren't a resident of Oregon the last day of the year, then none of the income would be included. And what the court said was that actually what we should be looking at in that case was a per-share, per-day allocation of income, so that you divide it up based on the time that they were a resident or a non-resident of the state. And that's what this House Bill 2454 would do, is say, look at the period of residency and the period of non-residency, take the income that's included on the federal return, and divide it accordingly. It still will pull into Oregon income all Oregon source income, but it's just looking at the residency period for the other types of income.
Deborah, one question relative to that. If I have an entity, a pass-through entity, that can identify its specific income based upon events that are taking place relative to income, deductions, and credits. For instance, the credit for the manufacturing device that was placed into production on a certain date, is there any way of specific identification under this bill?
Mr. Chair, there is not under this bill. I believe that an entity would be able to close its year and allocate all of the income and losses, deductions, et cetera, to a short time period. But there is no provision in the bill for specific identification. And I know you did ask that question when the bill was introduced by the committee. I did take a look at what other states are doing, and I did notice that New York, just in the last 3 months, has amended its law to put in a provision that allows
specific identification.
Well, it allows the commissioner or the taxpayer to elect to use specific identification for division of the income.
Okay.
But there's nothing in this bill.
So is that available to Oregon residents now under the but without a without a closing, an actual closing of the books of the pass-through entity, then there's no evidence, and they can do that, they can close that off, they can close that entity and restart it instantaneously without penalty, maybe pay an extra $10 if it's a corporation, an S-corporation, but that can be done without penalty so that the full year is still reported, and then if the triggering event of a non-resident becoming a resident or vice versa, then that would apportion the income then more correctly if that were in fact done.
Mr. Chair, I believe that is an option to them under federal law, and because we do follow that, if they had a closing of the books for federal purposes, I believe that would also apply for Oregon purposes.
Excellent. I that answers the question which I previously had, and that is the issue of specific identification relative to the part year non-resident and year and full year, or the part year resident, part year non-resident. Questions of either staff or Ms. Buchanan, colleagues? This is a much more straightforward issue dealing with the pass-through entities and just affords us an opportunity to actually apportion the pass-through entities where we have a part-year and a non-resident situation. With that, colleagues, is there any objection to us closing the public hearing and moving to a work session in this regard? Hearing seen. Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2454, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2454. Representative Galizio now moves House Bill 2454 to the full House of Representatives for a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, we will ask the clerk to call a roll.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I was just wondering if this rises to the level or falls to the level of a consent bill, just because it is an administrative rule already, the rather technical changes.
Representative, I think that's an excellent question. Because I'm already carrying one pass-through entity bill, I think I'll carry both of these together and we'll have a brief discussion on pass-through entities and get them passed off the floor, passed through the floor. So I appreciate that that recommendation and thought, but let's go ahead and plan to do this. And these are weighty issues, and we'll see more of them. So with that, clerk, will you please call the roll?
Representative Boquist?
Excused.
I'm sorry. Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Galizio.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair House.
Aye.
Chair Butler.
Aye. And Representatives Comp and Boquist are excused. With that, colleagues, House Bill 2454 is moved to the full House with a due pass recommendation from the committee on House Committee on Revenue. And I'll carry that in conjunction with the earlier bill. We will now close the work session on House Bill 2454, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2451.
Chairman Butler and committee members, we've heard this bill before. This was the bill dealing with the working family child care tax credit that comes from the Department of Revenue. But basically, you also have a dash one amendment. So after our last meeting, basically we're talking about the minimum earned income threshold for the working family tax care credit. And so what we're now having in the dash one amendment is it just clarifies there that with the dash one, we would have the $6,000 of earned income from anywhere for Oregon residents, but a minimum earned income threshold for the working family child care credit would only be able to come from Oregon-only sources for non-residents. So basically, we split that up between residents and non-residents. And that was really what Bob Castagna had testified to. He is also seeing this amendment, and he thinks the amendment is fine. And so he said that he was most concerned about Oregon residents and that they not have this restriction if they are living and earning their income in another state. So basically, that's what the dash one is doing. I will point you to that there is a revenue impact. There are roughly about 200 non-residents that are disqualified from receiving the working family child care tax credit that currently are receiving that credit. They have, again, as we talked about last time, though, these part-year residents and non-residents have this credit apportioned depending on the amount of Oregon source income that they have. So for non-residents, they're claiming that portion of the percent of their total federal gross adjusted gross income that comes from Oregon sources. So if they have 100% of that income from Oregon sources, then they're going to be getting 100% of the credit. Otherwise, it's going to get portioned. And so basically what you see then is an average credit amount of only $127. So basically the revenue impact is, you know, roughly around $26,000 a year beginning in 05-06. This measure takes effect on or after 2005. So basically this is increasing revenues to the state because you're eliminating a tax credit for certain non-residents. And just so everyone's clear here, I'm assuming in these revenue numbers that we're not making no change to the tax treatment under current law for part-year residents, and that's from the amendment that we have in front of us. That's not real clear, but it is something that can be interpreted from the amendment.
But it's my understanding, Elizabeth, in this process, this will then benefit those families that just are Oregon families, that full year Oregon families that have Oregon income and will receive the full credit then.
Chairman Butler, that's correct in the sense that we aren't changing current law for Oregon residents at all. Mm-hmm. And as I was just saying as I did the revenue impact, I also assumed that part-year residents would not have their status changed either. It's okay. Just non-residents that we're talking about here. And it's just this minimum threshold that they're going to have to meet. It has to come from Oregon sources only.
Colleagues, we have before us the Dash 1 amendments dated 2-14-05 to House Bill 2451. Representative Berger now moves the Dash 1 amendments dated 2-14-05. Any objections? Discussion? Let's see. We'll go ahead and do this without a roll call. We will, hearing and seeing no objection, we will move the Dash 1s into the House Bill 2451. Now, House Bill 2451, as amended with the Dash 1 amendments, is before us for consideration for passage to the floor. Representative Berger now moves House Bill 2451 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments of 2-14-05 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing and seeing none, any objections? We will go ahead and call the roll if we would, could please. Christy?
Mm-hmm. Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Felicio?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Haas?
Aye.
Chair Butler?
Butler votes aye, and Representatives Berger, Representatives Boquist and Comp are excused. House Bill 2451, as amended with the Dash 1 amendments, passes, and we'll pass that to the floor. And Representative Haas, will you carry that to the floor, please, on behalf of the committee?
Delighted to.
Thank you very much. We will now close the work session on House Bill 2451. And colleagues, that reflects on my calendar that we have cleared today's calendar. Tomorrow, please join us at the, let's see, ANS Marketing, if you would like. And let's see, we were going to have the directions passed out to us now, maps.
It's 1:30. Right?
Oh, it's going to be different. Yeah.
Nope.
And
nope.
We will. We certainly invite anyone to come and participate with us. And I think let's see. We're planning on leaving at about 12:30 to be there at 1:30, and we'll be finished there at 3:00 to be back here by 4:00. Missing the Portland traffic, we hope. These are delightful people. I don't. And whose district is this?
That's Rosenbaum's.
Representative Rosenbaum. These are very delightful people. I assume they live in this very area here. He was acknowledged last year as the citizen of the community, citizen because of the contributions that he makes to the various area there. He's got this large fenced parking lot right across the street from I think it's Multnomah County, one of their elections division, and he gives the key to those folks to lock their cars in there when they're working late at night counting ballots and so forth, and basically turns his facility over to them. Very kind to them, very, very publicly spirited folks. And it's been my great pleasure to visit with him. I think I came in contact with him when we were talking about this issue of stamping tobacco a few years back. So if you'd like to invite Representative Rosenbaum to come along and join us to meet some of her constituents there, again, they're delightful people and very, very publicly minded, public spirit minded. And I think Mrs. Camp has had a commercial business of sewing and knitting shops in the Portland area too. So they're good local business people as well. With that, colleagues, let's go ahead and close revenue for the day, and we will see you